Good morning, Vietnam. Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is it just me, or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Or is it Tony Tang on his brand new Yeti microphone? It indeed is the latter. All right, so I can tell this is already going to be a far more high-quality sound experience, and I'm in your head. All right, so we're going to pick up from where we left off last time. Third lecture of four, talking about the lessons from the design of everyday things. Next slide. So four learning objectives for today. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe why mismatches between user model and system model can create problems. I want you to be able to identify three distinct ways that people arrive at or develop their mental models. I want you to be able to describe two different kinds of mental models and discuss the differences between them. And of course, if we are helping people to develop their mental models, then you should be able to discuss the pros and cons of developing one or the other kind of mental model. The last thing I'd like you to do is be able to identify principles in the design of effective system images. Okay, so next slide. A lot of first few slides here are going to be recap from last time. It's just to set the stage for where we're going to head with these conceptual models or mental models. I use those two terms more or less interchangeably. So again, this is a Don Norman quote, right? In interacting with the environment, with others, and with the artifacts of technology, people form internal mental models of themselves and of the things with which they are interacting. These models provide both predictive and explanatory power for understanding the interaction, right? So just to recap then, this is essentially what a mental model is, right? It's kind of a person's understanding of how something works or how something is supposed to work. And if they have that understanding, then that helps them to have the ability to sort of predict what's going to happen and the ability to explain what is happening. All right, so next slide. So what is the distinction between conceptual models and conceptual design, right? So conceptual model, this is something that the user has or forms over time. This is the thing that they use to understand the system, right? And they rely on this while they use the system that you have created for them, right? So it's their sort of understanding of what's going on. And I say that they understand the system through the mental model very deliberately. So not only is it the case that they understand what the results of the system are through their mental model, but everything that they see is filtered through that mental model. And so it sort of colors how they see all the stuff that is going on. And hopefully I'll provide you with a concrete example of that as we go. Okay, conceptual design is something that the designer does. So what the designer is trying to do is define an intended mental model. So this is what I want you to think is going on. This is how I want you to understand the complexities of what's going on. And conceptual design then is about sort of designing a suitable system image to convey a certain mental model. Okay, and one way to think about this is if you think about how we build software APIs and libraries. So often, if the developer is doing a very good job, right, the package provides you with a way of understanding of what's going on underneath, except for it may not exactly be what is happening underneath, right? They're providing you with a system image so that you can develop a mental model of how to use this thing, but that system image may not be exactly what is actually happening underneath. They're just saying, you know, this is how you can think about it, and that'll be fine. Okay, so that's one way that you can think about it. Next image, I already showed you this last time. So the designer's role is to provide a meaningful, useful system image so that the user's model matches the design model. So the idea is that the user's mental model is close to what the designer intends. Of course, it's never the case that the designer and the user actually get together and chat, right? They never get to do that. Their whole interaction happens through the system image, right? What is presented of the system by the designer. The designer makes that choice, right? So again, through the use of the system, through the system image, of course, the user develops a mental model, right? And the hope is, if the system image is a good one, then the designer's model or the design model and the user's model are in sync somehow. And you end up with problems when these two things are not in sync. So I'll just show you that. Oh, okay. Well, one more thing. Okay. So next slide. Next slide here. Just some terms. Design model, what the designer intends to convey, right? So this is what they hope that this the user understands. The system image is what the user sees. The UI, the documentation, labels, kind of how the interaction works, all that sort of stuff. The user's model is the user's mental model, which is developed through interaction with the system, right? So a way to think about it is that it's a belief system about the system model, right? Okay, so next slide. So this is what happens when there are mismatches between a user's model and a system model. Sometimes a poor model is fostered deliberately. Consider a fridge or a heating system in a house versus the heating cooling system in a car. And so here I'll give you a quick example. So the thermostat in your house, right? You go inside, let's say it's a cold day outside, you go into your house and you're like, dang, somebody left this on cold. So you turn it up super high, right? Let's say we're doing it in Celsius. So a typical room temperature might be what, 20 degrees, 21, somewhere in there, let's say. You walk into your house, you're like, it's freezing in here. Let's heat this place up. So you turn it on full blast, right? You turn it up to 30 degrees. Well, actually, this and you're right, your thinking is that in fact this will heat your house faster than if you just set it to say 21 or 20 degrees. So it turns out that in fact this will not happen. This doesn't work that way. That's not how heating systems work in houses, generally speaking. So in fact, all heating systems in the house do generally is just turn on the heater and then they just kind of heat the house until basically you run out until the thermostat says, hey, we're at whatever degree you set it to, 21, 30. And it'll keep running until it reaches that temperature. Let's say you put it to 40. It would keep running probably forever because your house probably can't make it to 40 degrees until it turns off. All right. So in fact, you know, you're thinking about setting it to high, you know, 30 degrees, doesn't make it actually go to 30 degrees any faster than if you just set it to 21. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. In contrast, the heating and cooling system in a car is actually quite different. So turning it to different temperatures, or kind of that right knob that you can see in the image there, actually does change the temperature of the air that is being pumped out. So the thermostat in your house is actually a thermostat. It is judging the temperature of the air, whereas the quote-unquote thermostat in a car is not judging the temperature of the air. It's just basically blowing air at that temperature. Of course, there are sort of high-tech cars now. Not quite sure how those work, but this is in principle sort of some of the mismatches that happen between a user's model, kind of how we understand the world, and actually how the system itself works. So if you hit the next slide, you can see that sometimes it's a representation problem, right? So document sizes are often measured in bytes, not pages or words, right? So we often think about documents, Word documents in pages or words, right? I'll give you an assignment and it's supposed to be no more than 4 pages, let's say. Dates may be in non-standard formats. So, you know, how it's represented internally is going to be sometimes different than how it's supposed to be represented out externally. Error messages may use system-specific codes, which are more or less useless, right? Other times, it's essentially the designer is not the user problem, right? That the design model uses terms or concepts that are non-existent in the user's model, right? So often it's the case that, you know, the system uses words that make no sense to the person that is actually using the system, right? Remember the main lesson from the first day, you are not the user, right? So if you hit the next slide, this is just an image I took of my router's configuration page. I hope there is nothing here that will allow you to hack me, but I'm pretty sure you wouldn't anyway. Anyway, so a couple of quick questions, right? So if I were to ask you, essentially, where would you find the real-time bandwidth use viewer, right? So this would be some viewer that you could use, some visualization that you could use to see in real time how much bandwidth was being used. So see if you can figure that out. Second thing to see if you can, and actually pull out a piece of paper, see if you can do this, actually. It'd be kind of interesting. Second thing to try to do, what does the little buddy guy on the top right-hand corner do? And you can probably see him. He's next to the, or he's underneath the word that says English. So just try to figure that out. And let's, as a third task, let's imagine that you wanted to open up some ports for games or set up a demilitarized zone, right?
DMZ,
right? See if you can figure out how you do that just by looking at this, right? Or let's say you wanted to figure out, okay, well, how many open flows are there in my network? What sockets are open right now, right? And what are they connected to? So I want you to think about those four things. Look at this, just this one image, and see if you can figure out what you would do to actually get there, right? To get to each of these things. And I'll let you have a minute to do that. Of course, the podcast is going to continue rolling. You can actually check your answers, and you can they're just in the comments in the slide deck, and you can see whether or not you got it right. Okay, so hopefully you did that and found out that, in fact, most of your answers are wrong. That is the hope, anyway. It's possible that they weren't, and some of you were awesome. But at any rate, the point here is, of course, that it's not necessarily perfectly obvious where each of these things are going to be just by looking at this page. This page is a system image, right? And there's a mismatch between my language or my articulation of what I would like to see and where, what my expectation is of where it might be in this list, and hopefully where it was in where, what your expectations of where it should be in this list. That's basically the point. That's a mismatch. And the consequence of this particular mismatch is that we can't find it right away, right? And it's going to take time. We got to click through all these pages and blah, 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 blah. So in some ways, the cost here is fairly low. But you can imagine that actually in a lot of situations when you don't understand what's going on, this can actually cause some serious problems, right? The other thing I'll point out is that all of the tasks that I gave it to you in the language of a network expert. Well, maybe not a network expert, but certainly a computer scientist, right? Many of the people that are asking these questions are probably not going to be using kind of this type of sophisticated language, let's say, right? Who uses the term demilitarized zone, right? So they might just be simply asking, like, where the heck is all my bandwidth? Like, who's using all my bandwidth? They may not even say that. Internet's slow. Why is the internet slow? Right? Does this page help you answer the question of why the internet is slow? Not really, right? What does the little buddy guy up in the top right-hand corner do? Does he open up MSN Messenger? I think that's a fairly reasonable question, right? How do I play games, right? Not open up ports or demilitarized zone. Nobody knows what that is, right? What are the current open flows? You know, nobody's going to ask that question, but they might just say, I think my router is not working very well, right? These are diagnostic versions of these tasks. But I think the point still remains, right? And it may actually be further exacerbated by the fact that these people are not using kind of computer science-y network terms for these concepts. And so it may even be harder for them to find these things in this interface. All right, so where do these mental models come from? The astute amongst you will notice that in my, hey, let's figure out some learning objectives here, I said that there were three ways that mental models are actually developed. In fact, I think there are actually four ways. And one is they use the system, right? During system usage, people develop an understanding of what is going on, or they kind of develop theories about what is going on based on their usage of the system, right? The second way is that they observe others using the system. They can do this by casual observation, perhaps. They can also do this by asking someone else to do this for me, right? They can also get formal training. When they get formal training, they watch somebody else do it, or they are trained what to do, essentially. The third thing that they can do is they can read about the system, right? So help manuals, tutorials, they might go online and Google something, right? They read about the system, read about other people's troubles, right? They can ask questions online on forums. This is the third way they can develop a mental model. The fourth way that actually kind of comes before all of this is a previous understanding. So they may actually have experiences with related systems or concepts, and they may bring that to bear on the system that they have here. The other thing that actually happens sometimes is that they have experience with systems that are perhaps unrelated to the system that's going on here. And that is actually when you start to see these mismatches between system model and user model. Or that's system and the user model, right? So a classic example of this would have been the old OS X used to have this thing where if you wanted to eject a disk, you would drag the disk from your desktop onto the trash bin, and putting it in the trash bin would actually physically eject the disk. It no longer does this anymore. When you click and drag the disk, the little trash bin turns into an eject button, which is, I suppose, supposed to be more clear. But you can still see how this is actually in principle quite different than how Windows deals with it, for example. So if you had experience with one system, it would kind of mess you up for the other system. That's essentially the point. If you hit the next slide, you can see now that just as a reminder that these mental models are sort of runnable, right? You can think of them as being sort of like little programs in your head. And so if you have a mental model of how the system is going to work, then you can look at the system and go, okay, well, if I press this button, this is what I expect to happen. And you might be right, you might be wrong, or you might actually have no theory about what happens, in which case your mental model is sort of incomplete, right? And so you'll notice that this includes a notion of causality, right? Doing this will result in this, right? And these two things are used for explanation, to understand why the system responds as it does. And it's also used for prediction, right? So that people can select the appropriate action given the situation. So they're in some situation and they want something else to happen, right? So they can run this little mental model in their head and they can go, oh, that's exactly what I want. And they can go backtrack one step and they can say, this is the one that I want. Right, so this is what we mean by mental models are runnable. Of course, this is all sort of like conceptual, theoretical, right? It's not necessarily the case that you've actually got like a little program that represents kind of the program that you're running in front of you. So if you hit the next slide, then there are two kinds of mental models that we talk about. One is called a structural model, and the other one is called a functional mental model. All right, so these are two general classes, and within these, there are a couple of slight smaller ones, okay? So I'll just try to describe these two different classes really quickly first, and then I'll dive into some of the different types of structural models, and then I'll describe what a functional model is. A structural mental model is an image of what the system actually is. It's descriptive of what the system is. The user may need additional knowledge to actually use it. So it's often more powerful, but it's harder to use, right? So this is something that even though you may have it, if it's not well developed, you may still run into problems, right? So the way to think about it is that a roadmap shows a particular type of information, but it's necessarily customized to your particular use of how that information is going, how you're going to actually make use of that information. So roadmap shows all sorts of stuff, right? But it doesn't necessarily show you how to get from point A to point B, right? Best way to think about this is you come into campus on the first day of school and they're like, hey, welcome to the U of C. Here's a map of campus, right? And that map is that useless isometric view. And you're like, okay, well, this is great, except for like, where the hell do I eat, right? There's no information on that map about where you should eat. and so somebody says, okay, well, Mac Hall is where you eat. They point out the map and you're like, okay, well, where the heck am I, right? And so this is an example of a map that actually has a lot of information. And actually, if you knew how the system worked, then the map is actually quite useful. But on the other hand, it doesn't help you to kind of deal with the situation that you have on hand right now, which is I'm standing kind of in front of Science A, and I'm hungry. What the heck do I do, right? So in contrast to that, if you imagine running into somebody and saying, hey, I'm really hungry right now, what do I do? And you're standing in front of Science A, they'll say, okay, well, I want you to head that way until you run into the end of the hall, then hang a left, then walk to the end of that, then you hang a right, and then you go in a little tunnel, and then you pop up on the other side, you go upstairs, and boom, there's all the food all over the place. That is a functional mental model, right? So it's very action-based. It describes how to use the system at hand, okay? So the way to think about a structural thing is it's an image of what the system is, and so it's great if you sort of understand it. And it's very powerful, right? It's very useful, you know, when you get it. But it doesn't help you to solve the problem that you have at hand. You know, to solve the problem that you have at hand, a functional model kind of often is quite useful, right? It's very prescriptive, very step-by-step. Does not assume global or system knowledge. It's easier to use, you can imagine that, right? But it's not really helpful for problem solving or dealing with the unexpected, right? So let's imagine that you kind of went into the tunnel and suddenly it's like, okay, close for construction, use a different route. If you had a functional model there, it's completely useless. You had those instructions from that person that gave it to you, right? Now you don't know what to do. On the other hand, if you actually understood how the map worked and you understood where you were in the map and you were holding the map in your hand, then you would know how to reroute yourself. So that's a structural model versus a functional model, right? So the way I think about that is that the contrast is between a roadmap, which shows all sorts of information but isn't customized to your particular use of it, versus Google directions, right? So when you do a Google Maps and you say, hey, give me some directions, it says, take this turn, go north for, whatever, 20 kilometers, 20.1 kilometers, veer right, then hang a left. Your second left or whatever it is, right? This is great when everything is there. It's not so great when a road is closed, right? You get just totally messed up. A functional model does not provide you with a good means to do troubleshooting, right? Or when something changes, right? So that's the fundamental difference between a structural model and a functional model. So let's get into some of these in a little bit more detail. In particular, there are lots of different kinds of structural models, right? So structural model, here's some maps and schematics. Here's an example, next slide. So this is an example of the C-Train map, obviously. Provides a very specific view of the system. You can see that it's use as needed. Here there might be different views, perhaps. A street or bus or bike maps of the same region are all customized to drivers, bus riders, and bikers. And all of these are sort of structural models of what's going on, right? So that's an example of a map or a schematic. You've seen these before. Another structural mental model is something we call an object action model. And so users think in terms of concrete or abstract objects, and the system essentially supports actions on the objects, right? So for example, in Unix, files are objects, and all the commands that we have in Unix, those are commands that basically act on those files, those objects, right? All your cat, your tr, your sed, your grep, your awk, all of these things are things that act on those files or those objects. In PowerPoint, very similar sort of thing. You basically have these objects, your text, your images, whatever it may be, and then you perform operations on these things, right? So that's another way of thinking about, you know, how a mental model may actually be constructed. Maybe constructed as an object action model. So I'd like you to think a little bit about what are some programs that you have used that you have sort of an objects that act or that we can act on objects kind of a model, right? So think about that. Next slide. Another type of structural model is an analogy or a metaphor, right? Where a new system sort of closely resembles an old system. And the idea is that usually that you help positive transfer of existing system knowledge, right? So if you think about how a desktop metaphor works, the basic idea was that there are folders, there are things, that there are files that go in the folders, that sort of stuff. And we can move them between folders and that sort of stuff, right? So there's a desktop metaphor. Spreadsheets are another metaphor, right? So the spreadsheet tools that we have, these are actually based on real big pieces of paper that were formed as in these spreadsheet-like things. So those are examples of structural models, that different kinds of structural models that people actually develop. And the way to think about this is that this is simply a way of articulating the type of structural model that is being developed. In terms of functional models, these are the how the system is used type of models. I think of them as being kind of like this. I've complained lots about PeopleSoft, for example, right? The University of Calgary is actually very helpful, though. They're not blind to the fact that this is a very difficult system to use. And so what they do is they provide what are called job aids. So if you just Google University of Calgary job aids, you'll probably pull up one of these. And I think this link still works, so you can try to hit it if you want. And what you can see is that this is a really, you know, step-by-step procedural guide on how to do something. And these are great. When they're developed, they work, and everything is awesome. The problem is that they get stale really, really fast. As soon as somebody changes something in the UI, changes the URL to something, or they just decide to change the process somehow, then all of these job aids break. And that is the problem, right? If something that I'm doing is not, if they've changed the system somehow, or something I'm doing is a little bit different from what they expect, then the job aid doesn't work anymore. So two different kinds of functional models. One is called a state transition model. And this is how most of us think of how the phone works. What you see on the right is a representation of the model, right? So this is how we think the phone actually works, right? So it's on the hook. We lift it off the hook. Then get a dial tone. We dial digits. And while we dial digits, we hear silence. We wait for either a busy or ringing, so on and so forth. And if this is the kind of model that you want to provide, then changes in the state need to be perfectly visible. Otherwise, this kind of model doesn't form properly. And so you can see that each of these little circles, the phone actually presents you with a different state. And the state that it presents you in terms of feedback is a different sound, right? So it's a dial tone, it's silence, either ringing or busy, or it's answered, right, by somebody picking it up, right? So you hear all these different states, and it's really, really clear. So when you have these different states and you present them really clearly, then you're doing a little bit better. Another type of functional model is a mapping model, where users learn a sequence of actions to accomplish tasks. The problem is that these mappings need to be rote learned. They're often arbitrary. Handheld calculator maps math to key presses or keyboard shortcuts. I think that University of Calgary job aids is a good example of this type of mapping. Another example is a phone that has, you know, these arbitrary mappings to do things like put a call on hold, or do a reverse dial, or do a, you know, call forward. These are kind of, you know, arbitrary sequences that you basically have to remember. They're rote learned. There's no reason for them, essentially, right? *69, whatever it might be. Next slide. So a system image. This is all this designers control what the users see through the system image, and that's it. So your goal in trying to help people develop a good kind of mental model of what's going on in the system is to develop a system image in such a way that it fosters a good mental model. Some interfaces actually display the whole system, right? Where all objects and actions might be visible at all times. So, a car's dashboard is often quite literal. This is actually your car, right? And the best example of this is a mechanical one, obviously. Right? This is actually your car. This is what is actually happening, right? Some basic principles for designing the system image, I think of there being kind of three. One is that there's currency, that is that it's sort of up to date, that it's not kind of lagging, sort of, is important, right? And the second thing is consistency. So if it's consistently responding, no matter what the circumstances are, this contributes to learnability. And the last thing is that you want it to be providing feedback, you know, quickly and effectively. And that feedback needs to be obvious. It needs to be clear. And if you have these things going on, then it helps people to understand what's going on. The feedback thing, of course, is related to that concept that we talked about last time, which is causality, right? If something that I do takes a long time for me to see the result of it, then I may forget that, in fact, I'd pressed that thing in the past, right? So currency, consistency, and feedback, these three things lead to effective system images, which contribute to people developing good user models. Next slide. Where a simple model might be better to hide system complexity. Many systems have messy low-level details, and they're irrelevant to a user's activity. Full functionality may not be required. So in the slide here, I give an example of how Microsoft Word tries to hide some of that complexity, and users can actually hide some of that complexity through customization. Another example of this happening is often kind of the APIs that you use, say, in Java. Right, some of them might actually be doing very complex things, but they present to you a very simple model so that you can actually make effective use of them. IT admins can provide macro capabilities. So, for example, the submit program that you probably used in first or second year to submit your programs to the prof for assignments. This is an example of a program that actually did a whole bunch of different things, but they tried to package it up and make it very simple. Right? Wizards are a way of doing this too, right? They allow a person to do what is right, and they, you know, skip sort of what they consider to be unnecessary system details. So today what we talked about was primarily conceptual models, and we kind of did a really deep dive into that. We also talked a little bit about how to develop good system images, and I talked about the relationship between the system image and conceptual design and a user model. All right, that's it. Thank you.